From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now. Parents, students, and school districts are feeling growing frustration over maintaining in-person classes through the current COVID-19 surge. In New York City yesterday, thousands of students staged a walkout over safety measures they called inadequate. And in Oakland, California, students have threatened not to attend class if schools cannot meet their health and testing demands. But many officials are adamant that schools should remain open in person, including Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, who joins us now. Secretary Cardona, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
Well, I want to start with the question on many parents' minds right now. Is it safe for my kids to be in school with Omicron spreading so quickly?
Jane, I do believe it is safe. My children attend school daily. My wife, who works in a school, goes daily. And we know what to do to keep our families and communities safe. We have better tools today. We have the experience of over a year doing this. And we understand how it spreads. So I do believe it's safe. I also want folks to think about how unsafe it is when children are not in school, when they're sitting home, maybe less supervised, or when they're dealing with the emotional stress of not being a part of school and the school communities that they love.
Well, let me ask you about testing, because the White House has announced the administration is making 5 million rapid tests and 5 million PCR tests available to schools across the country starting this month. That's on top of $10 billion devoted to school-based testing. But with everything that's happening across the country in schools right now, is it enough?
I do believe if we use the test for test-to-stay practices for those who are unvaccinated, and we continue to increase the number of students who have access to vaccine to get their vaccine, and we follow the mitigation strategies that we know have worked for the last year and a half, yes, I do believe our schools should be safe, and should be open. Let me remind you, all other places are open. So for us to be considering whether or not schools should be open should be the last thing we should be thinking about.
You mentioned the test and stay policies. The CDC is set to release new guidance later this week to help schools implement those test and stay policies, in which schools use these rapid tests to keep close contact of kids who test positive in class. It just seems to me, Mr. Secretary, that schools are really not equipped to navigate all the policies and guidelines that seem to change sometimes by the day. These are schools, not clinics. How can we make this easier for them?
Right. You know, that's a good point. And I can tell you from March 2020, when this first started, we relied very closely on health guidance. Recently, we sent out something to districts across the country, sharing with them what we believe are the best strategies to keep schools open. And one of those strategies is having a very strong relationship with our health partners. And at the district level, it's really important that our superintendents are working closely with their public health experts so that as the guidance comes out and it changes, we can adapt quickly and nimbly so that our students have the best opportunity to learn in person.
You say you worry about less structure and less supervision. Let me ask you then about staff shortages, because teachers are getting sick and many schools cannot hold classes because they simply don't have enough people.
Right.
President Biden has said that reopening schools is a priority. What is your administration doing about this?
You know, we, through the American Rescue Plan, provided $130 billion across the country. We are emphasizing that those funds can be used to address some of the staffing shortages. Some strategies, I know Kentucky recently and Connecticut recently announced that they're bringing back retired teachers without any penalty to their retirement pay. We know that there are bonuses for substitute teachers, for bus drivers. We understand, however, that Omicron has provided that challenge. But I am pleased that the new CDC guidance limits the quarantining time to 5 days, which will help keep our schools staffed by the educators and give our students the best chance to learn in person.
There are also children who are too young to be vaccinated right now. And even with the promises your administration has made for new tests to be made available, how is it, Mr. Secretary, that 2 years into this pandemic, parents are scrambling to find tests, to administer tests to these kids? I mean, I'm one of those parents on the hunt, on a scavenger hunt to find tests for my kids. Why is it so hard 2 years in?
Right. You know, and I understand that, and this Omicron really came quickly. 500 million tests have been committed, 10 million per month for schools. But let me just remind, and I'm a parent too, and for me, the safety of my children is the most important thing. Vaccinating our children where possible. And for those who have children who are under the age of five who can't be vaccinated, it's really important that the people that are around their children are vaccinated to protect them. We're going to continue to work hard to make tests available and accessible, but we also recognize that relying solely on tests is not going to get us through this pandemic.
Looking forward, how are you going to better prepare schools for what may be coming?
Well, you know, we know that partnership with health departments, having access to surveillance testing, which is something that we've been promoting since March, we know that works. But most importantly, increase access to vaccination. What we're seeing in our hospitals today, much of that is preventable. So we're going to continue beating that drum that vaccinations work, they're free, and they're the best way to protect our students, our staff, and our community.
That was Education Secretary Miguel Cardona. Mr. Secretary, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're having important conversations right now about voting rights, but a complicated election law that dates back well over a century is also getting fresh scrutiny from lawmakers. The Electoral Count Act of 1887 was originally created to help resolve disputes over election results, but many law experts say it's rife with problems.
The crafters of this law unfortunately did a terrible job, and it's very vague, it's unclear. Some of the processes don't make sense in the modern world.
That's Rebecca Green, a law professor at William & Mary. Miles Parks covers voting for NPR, and he's been looking into efforts to change the Electoral Count Act. Welcome.
Hey there.
Miles, how did this law come into being, and what was the original intent?
So a little bit of history. The Constitution does have the basic details for how federal elections in this country should work. But in 1876, there was a contested presidential election that essentially pushed the rules in the Constitution to the limit. Three states sent in competing election results, and Congress simply had no rules in place to deal with such a scenario. They made an ad hoc committee, which gave the presidency to Rutherford B. Hayes and effectively ended Reconstruction. And then a few years later, Congress was like, we do not want to deal with that again. And so they passed this law so that hopefully it wouldn't happen again.
Well, we've already heard that this law wasn't well crafted. I mean, can you lay out for us a little bit more about that and other issues with the law?
Sure. So the biggest issue is that it was crafted to give clarity to the elections process. But the problem is it doesn't really do that. It sets out a bunch of dates and deadlines to make sure things are timely. But election experts and law experts say it's dense, it's poorly written. One report said the current statute alludes vaguely to the possibility that a state's presidential election could result in failure, for instance, but it provides no definition or constraints of what that failure could be. Another problem that experts point to is how easy it is for members of Congress to object to election results. Right now, as the act stands, it takes only two out of the hundreds of members of Congress to say, I have a problem with these election results, and essentially push it to a vote, delay the process, muck up the process. And election experts, legal experts say it should be a lot harder. There should be some sort of threshold that members of Congress shouldn't be able to mess with the process without having some real issue to point to.
This law also doesn't provide a lot of clarity about the role of the vice president, right, in the counting process. And we remember that former President Trump tried to pressure Mike Pence to overturn the 2020 election results. Can you explain the problems with the vice president's role specifically?
Yeah, and this issue comes back to the vagueness of the law again. You know, the Electoral Count Act gives the vice president a number of roles within the elections process as it's being certified, preserving order and decorum, opening and handling the state electoral vote certificates, calling for objections. But all of these roles are ministerial. Experts say the VP was never intended to have some sort of role in actually deciding who wins the election. And if that was clearer, a lot of people think January 6th probably would have happened differently. So much of that was about trying to pressure Mike Pence into doing something that the law says, basically, he was never meant to do, and they're hoping that Congress now can update it so it's a little bit more clear that that's the case.
With that, how much bipartisan support is there actually to change the law now? And is it likely to be changed in a meaningful way?
So there does seem to be bipartisan energy here. Even Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said last week that the law does have flaws and he'd be open to a conversation about it. Moderate Democrats like Joe Manchin say the same thing. But the holdup at this point is actually the more liberal Democrats who see Republicans' openness to this law as a way that they can kind of get out of engaging with other issues on voting rights. They're saying basically what Chuck Schumer put it was they want to talk about the scorekeeping when the game itself is rigged. And so it's unclear whether Democrats are going to engage with this sort of conversation if Republicans are not willing to engage on some of the other conversations about voting, about overhauling some of the bigger things in the voting process. Election experts, though, say basically, we hope they can do something because this law needs to get fixed before 2024.
That's NPR's voting reporter, Miles Parks. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The journey to pregnancy isn't always easy. Anna Brown of Hawaii knows this firsthand.
I remember a few years ago just sitting on our bed crying after coming home from a doctor's appointment where I was told I would likely never be able to have biological children without egg freezing and surrogacy, neither of which we can afford. But in the meantime, I decided to not give up hope. To have that hope be rewarded has been one of the greatest joys of my entire life.
Well, the pandemic has certainly complicated her pregnancy experience. She and her husband lost their jobs and are forging new paths. And her landlord is taking advantage of a booming real estate market and selling their home. They have about a month left to find a new place to live.
But by far, the greatest impact of COVID for us has been the loss of my husband's mom, who raised him as a single mother. She was unvaccinated, and after spending over a month on a ventilator, she died just 4 days after her 55th birthday. Her favorite holiday was Christmas. I always dreamed of the first Christmas that we would get to share with her and her first grandbaby. It brought me so much joy to imagine her absolute delight. And it hurts to think about all the moments that she won't be there for.
All of the storms Anna Brown has weathered have made her even more determined to protect her health and that of her growing family. She is among the 42% of pregnant adults who are fully vaccinated in the U.S., but she's not boosted yet. Just how many women are in her position is not clear, as the CDC hasn't released what it knows so far about how many pregnant people have received boosters. We've heard from dozens of you writing in with questions about being pregnant during the pandemic, and to help us answer some of those questions is Dr. Linda Eckert. She is with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the University of Washington School of Medicine. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So before we get to questions from vaccinated women, I want to underline that more than half of pregnant people in this country are still not fully vaccinated. That's less than the general population. What are some of the theories as to why?
Well, I think pregnant women in general are very hesitant to take any medications, whether it be vaccines or pills through their mouth, et cetera. And we've seen this traditionally with vaccines in pregnancy, where even with flu vaccine, we typically only get about 50% of women vaccinated. I think with COVID, a challenge was that pregnant women were not included in the original trials that the manufacturers did. And I think that we've been playing catch up since we started immunizing pregnant women and getting data about how safe this vaccine was in pregnancy, how well it was working, and how well it's protecting mothers and their babies.
Can you dispel some of the concerns or maybe add context to it? What do we know about the impacts of COVID-19 on an unborn child? And does getting infected while pregnant offer any immunity to a baby after birth?
Well, those are great questions that have been a little bit difficult to research, but we're starting to get more and more data. We do know that if a pregnant individual acquires COVID in pregnancy, it can be much more dangerous than a similar peer who's not pregnant. The risk of being on a ventilator is about 15 times greater, And there's a 4 times increased risk of stillbirth that we saw with the Delta wave. And the risk of death, depending on the study, is about 15 to 22 times greater. So I think the best way to protect your baby isn't to acquire COVID, but is to get the vaccine and pass the protection through your umbilical cord and your breast milk to the baby.
Something else, being fully vaxxed does not always mean getting the booster shot. Like Anna Brown, who we heard from earlier, she received her vaccine doses prior to pregnancy. And now that she's expecting, it's a different risk calculus to make. Let's listen.
I strive to be as vigilant as ever in my personal COVID precautions, and I'm trying to hold out till my third trimester to get my booster shot, as I've read that the most protection may be passed on to the baby then.
Dr. Eckert, Anna wonders, when is the best time in pregnancy to get a booster to give the most benefit to the mother and the baby?
Well, we're starting to get more data about that, and there was just a recent study out that looked at 1,300 pregnant individuals who had been vaccinated against COVID. And indeed, if you get the booster up closer to when you deliver, you do have a higher level of antibody protection. But I would say that the antibody protection, even if you receive the vaccine early in pregnancy, is still high. And so what we are recommending, frankly, is the best thing to do is to think about protecting the pregnant mother. Get your booster when it's suggested to happen, whether that's 6 months after your Moderna or 5 months after your Pfizer. And that once you are protected, that protection will pass to your baby, whether it happens in the second trimester, first trimester, or third trimester.
Okay, we've heard from several pregnant listeners who have had their booster, like Christine Tran of Los Angeles. She's pregnant with her second child, and she worries about her 3-year-old contracting COVID at daycare and bringing it home.
I have a pretty much non-existent personal network. We rely pretty heavily on daycare and have never hired a nanny. I was vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson prior to getting pregnant, and then several months later was boosted with Pfizer.
Christine wonders what information you can share about the outcomes of people who are fully vaxxed but infected and possibly giving birth while infected. Is there data from the last 2 years that gives us insight?
We are seeing in this new wave individuals who've been vaccinated acquiring COVID. And when you do have COVID, when you deliver, of course, you may not get the delivery experience you want. You may not be able to have as many people present with you in the room. You may not be able to visit the nursery where your child might be kept. And so it definitely does have implications for the delivery that are not desirable for sure. But also, getting vaccinated still offers protection against the most dangerous implications of getting COVID in pregnancy.
Can you really parse out just a little bit more on the risks for vaccinated versus unvaccinated pregnant people? Are vaccinated people still just as vulnerable to COVID?
Absolutely not. They are protected in a way that decreases the serious complications, such as needing a ventilator, needing a prolonged hospitalization, even death. And so becoming vaccinated is the best way that you can protect you and your unborn baby against COVID.
We've also received questions about general safety. Listener Hillary Oliver of Missoula, Montana asks this.
I'm vaccinated and boosted and out of caution, decided to spend the holidays away from relatives who were not vaccinated. I didn't spend any time indoors unmasked with anyone who was unvaccinated. But now with Omicron, it seems like it might not be safe to spend time even with vaccinated people. Like maybe I can actually contract it from a vaccinated friend. Should I be even more cautious now?
Doctor, her question really echoes what we've been hearing from other listeners who work in schools or use public transportation and wonder what they can do to further protect themselves besides getting vaccinated and wearing a mask. I mean, how much should pregnant people be limiting their contact with others at this point? Should they even gather with friends and family right now?
I personally am recommending all of my pregnant patients, of course, to be vaccinated and boosted, but to wear N95 masks if they can get them, or KN95. And I am recommending them to try to limit contact. We do know that masks have worked well traditionally, but the Omicron seems to be, you know, highly infectious. And I would recommend trying to go beyond a cloth mask. But I agree with you. We're seeing this as well, that people who are vaccinated and boosted are acquiring Omicron, whether they're pregnant or not. And so I do think it merits special caution.
I know the data is still out on this question I'm about to ask you, but we received it. And that is, how will getting COVID while pregnant affect the baby's development?
Yeah, that is something that we're studying. And I think if you can recover from the COVID and have the baby at term, we have seen that women with COVID do have an increased risk of getting hypertension in pregnancy. But we haven't really seen some other complications such as low birth weight if the baby can be born at term. We are, of course, following those babies and following their antibodies and following how they do. And, you know, since we've only got a year's worth of pregnancies now, having had the vaccine and having delivered since the vaccine came out, it's really hard to give you a long-term answer about that.
Dr. Linda Eckert is with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She's also a professor specializing in infectious diseases and immunization at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Dr. Eckert, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this opportunity.
And we will have links to some of the studies and data that Dr. Eckert mentioned at hereandnow.org. Has your United Airlines flight been canceled in the past few days? The airline is reducing flights because about 3,000 employees have recently tested positive for the coronavirus. JetBlue and Alaska Airlines have also made temporary reductions to flight schedules as Omicron continues to sweep across the nation. And Delta Airlines is facing opposition from flight attendants over the airline's updated isolation protocols. There's a lot to talk about. And with us to talk about it is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, who joins us now. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tanya.
So United is not alone in dealing with staff shortages due to COVID infections. How does this look across the industry?
Yeah, these airlines have basically taken turns over the last several months being in bad shape. It's been United's turn here for a few weeks, and not United alone, as you said. American and Southwest a few months ago were a mess. They kind of got their hands around it. United had fairly brazenly in early November sent an email out to customers saying, hey, look at us. We're doing rather well. You can count on us for your holiday travel plans. They were more aggressive about adding flights to meet what was then higher travel demand. And now here they are in this situation. Delta, also an airline that over the years has been rather reliable in terms of not canceling a lot of flights, has hit more of a rough patch here over the past month or so.
And then there are airlines like Southwest, though, that have not done so. How are they dealing with the COVID surge?
Yeah, Southwest hit another, to use the same term again, a real rough patch there a couple months ago. And they were canceling a lot of flights along with American. And actually both of those airlines, yes, notably Southwest, doing rather well now. And that's partly at least because of the fact that they did some of the things that United, as you mentioned, Alaska and JetBlue are now having to do, sort of be more conservative about reducing flights. And so they're just kind of not trying to do as much now as they were before when they were running with less margin for error. So at this point, Southwest and American, more reliable. The history, though, is that if you try to sort of get ahead of this and outsmart yourself in terms of which airline to book a couple months later, it's not the same airline that you booked necessarily that's in better shape than the others.
So with that, I mean, what is your advice for people who have a flight coming up? Are airlines offering refunds for people who might want to cancel?
Well, if you cancel on them at this point, typically you're not going to get a refund. You'll likely get a full credit as opposed to years ago where they would have also charged a cancellation fee. Depends, of course, on the airline. If they cancel on you, then you are entitled to a refund. Of course, that might be small consolation if you miss your plans or if you've prepaid a hotel room or a car rental. But it can be worth actually waiting to see if they cancel on you because you'll have more rights on that case than if you cancel on them. But no question, there's a, you have to kind of leave, well, here's that term again, more margin for error for yourself these days because the industry overall has been, it's not just anecdotal, statistically less reliable than it has typically been in recent years.
I mean, so essentially what I'm hearing from you is wait and see. That's Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
We all know America's history with slavery. At least we think we do. Well, a reporting project by The Washington Post is showing us a new facet. They've documented just how many American lawmakers were themselves slaveholders. That includes 12 of the first 18 U.S. presidents. Slave-owning members of Congress were not just from the South, not just from the early days of this country, and not members of any single political party. We're joined now by one of the project's reporters, The Washington Post's Julie Weil. Hi, Julie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you uncovered quite a rich and full picture of slaveholding in early America. What did you find?
I created a database listing every member of the U.S. Congress who was ever a slaveholder historically. And what I found was that there were more than 1,700 slaveholders elected to Congress, starting from the early years, from 1789 when Congress began. In those initial years, more than half of all congressmen for many a Congress were slaveholders. And going all the way into the 20th century, there were still former slaveholders serving in Congress.
And these were U.S. congressmen who represented 37 states. These were slaveholders not just from the South, but from every state in New England, much of the Midwest, and many Western states, right?
That's right. And I was surprised how long it took before slavery started to disappear in the Northern states. There were slaveholders I was finding in the 1820 census in New England and in the 1830 census in Pennsylvania and New York and New Jersey. It really was a nationwide institution.
The last lawmakers to have enslaved people were in office well into the 20th century, well into the 1920s. What does that say about the long, slow path to recognizing our painful history?
It really, I think, says a lot about who the people who were in power were in initially all of the country and eventually in the southern states. When you look at these wealthy families who were sending people to Congress, sometimes they were among the last slaveholders in their communities. The state of Delaware had very few slave owners by the time the Civil War started, but both of their senators were slaveholders. These were the people who held power.
There was a Democrat, Rebecca Latimer Felton, who was a suffragist and a white supremacist and the first woman ever to serve in the Senate. She was a former slave owner.
She's the one and only woman, and she turns out to be the only female slaveholder to serve in Congress and the very last slaveholder to serve in Congress.
What are some of the other stories that stick out to you about your research?
You know, there's one that really sort of haunted me. There was a story of James Worthington was a congressman representing the Baltimore area who had an enslaved daughter, product of the congressman raping an enslaved woman. And he sold his daughter to a man who wanted her to bear more children who would be enslaved. And she refused. And the man who had purchased her beat her to death. And there's a man who was enslaved alongside her who escaped, who wrote a very moving account of this incident. And he wrote about all the American laws to keep back the soul. So those words from James Watkins, the former slave, it just chilled me the first time I read them, because that's really what this is about. It's about the laws that these men were passing that kept people in bondage across the country and in their own homes. So that's the quote that's been rattling through my mind.
Well, and on the other side of this, one interesting thing is how the history often written about many of these lawmakers is wrong. They're described as abolitionists, supportive of ending slavery, but the truth is many of them actually own slaves. So your work here is really about correcting or adding a fuller picture to the record, isn't it?
Exactly. There are stories that are incomplete. It's not that the story's wrong. Both are true. Some of these people, if you look at someone like Rufus King or Charles Minor or John Floyd, they're better remembered for their anti-slavery actions than they are for the fact that if you go and look at the census records, they were enslaving people in their own households. But both are true.
Have you heard from the descendants of any of these lawmakers or any of the families whose ancestors were enslaved?
I have. I have been surprised by how many emails are coming in the past day or two from people who were descended from these congressmen. And especially gratifying are the people who are descended from congressmen who I wasn't sure whether they were slaveholders or not. This work is not finished. There's still a list of more than 600 congressmen who I'm looking for records on. And I've had quite a few emails saying, hey, that person on your list you're not sure about, he was my great-great-great-great-grandfather, and I have a letter he wrote, or I have a will, or something like that, and people are sending me records. It's really, really amazing to know what's out there. And I'm hoping more people will keep helping and I can finish the list.
That's Julie Weil, a reporter with The Washington Post. Julie, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Researchers know that climate change has contributed to reducing ice on northern lakes and ponds in wintertime, with important consequences for their ecosystems. They're getting help from citizen scientists who are documenting those changes and contributing their data. Here is reporter Emma Jacobs.
In the 1980s, an enthusiastic lake researcher named Ken Stewart started looking for volunteers.
He would recruit people using the local chamber of commerce, sporting goods stores. He would go in and speak to people about who might live on a lake.
This is Stewart's former student, Gerald Bove. He says Stewart's recruits started recording the dates of the winter freeze and spring thaw for their lakes, more than 1,000 across 5 northern states. They sent them by postcard to Stewart, nicknamed the Iceman by his colleagues at the University at Buffalo.
His wife, artist, made him retire from actually going out on the ice at some point in his early 80s. She said, I really don't want you going out on too many more frozen lakes.
Stewart's now 90, but his network is still collecting data.
So there's a little skim of ice here. Not right there, huh?
Doug Fitzgerald has trudged out by foot and in his truck to track 7 lakes and ponds in northern New York since 1992.
Well, I was a young man when I started this, so now not so much. So.
Air temperature is, of course, key for water to freeze, but Fitzgerald's lakes all lie within a 7-mile radius and still freeze on different dates because some are deeper or more exposed to wind or light.
And there's one pond where there's a distinct flow of water through. So that stays open longer. So I do make a judgment call on that. But what I try to do is be consistent every year.
Consistent so it's useful to scientists, like Sapna Sharma, an ecologist at York University in Toronto.
Ice acts like a lid for a lake. You can think of it acts like a lid on a lake in the winter.
Sharma has come on to co-run the Lake Ice Project. She explains the number of days ice covers the surface, days that lid is on, has year-round impacts on water quality and temperature.
What's happening to your dissolved oxygen levels in the lake? Oxygen is incredibly important for all those creatures living in the lake.
Her recent research has shown ice season is getting shorter across the northern hemisphere, and that trend is speeding up. She says tens of thousands of lakes could stop freezing consistently, even under optimistic warming scenarios. She says analysis of the volunteers' data could help forecast how fast individual lakes and local ecosystems will change.
Okay, so the White House is where I lived when I was born.
Nancy Quillian has lived her whole life with a view of Glen Lake in Queensbury, New York. She's sent in data for decades without thinking too much about it, but noticed some change herself.
My memory as a kid is we were always skating by Christmas. And now it's a little iffy.
At 73, she also notes another challenge facing the new heads of the research effort, bringing on a new generation of data gatherers.
Probably should pass it on to somebody much younger.
Someday, there may no longer be dates to record for Glen Lake, if it's among those that stop freezing altogether. Then the data would become a historical record of a past era in North American winters. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs.
It was a long time coming. For 6 years, NPR has pursued an interview with Donald Trump. He finally gave it this week. The former president still holds immense influence over the Republican Party, and he continues to spread the lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. But when NPR pressed him about these false claims, it only took 9 minutes before he hung up. NPR Steve Inskeep spoke to Trump, and he joins us now. And Steve, you began by asking the former president about Republicans who are not supporting his false claim of election fraud. It's a long list. How did he respond when you pressed him?
This, to me, was a critical question because the 2022 election year is beginning, and we wanted to know if Trump, who is still effectively the leader of his party, is going to press 2022 candidates to relitigate his 2020 defeat. You mentioned there is a long list of Republican officials who are reluctant to go there. Not as long a list, we should mention, of Republican voters, because the vast majority of Republican voters have said they believe the lies about a stolen election. So we began this discussion by asking the former president about this. Let's listen. South Dakota Senator Mike Rounds, as I think you know, was on ABC over the weekend. He spoke about the 2020 election and also referred to the election campaign that is now starting in 2022. Let's listen.
We simply did not win the election as Republicans for the presidency. And if we simply look back and tell our people don't vote because, you know, there's cheating going on, then we're going to put ourselves in a huge disadvantage. A
couple of things to ask about there, Mr. President. Let's start with the politics. Is it a disadvantage for Republicans to keep talking about the 2020 election in 2022?
No, I think it's an advantage because otherwise they're going to do it again in 22 and 24. And Rounds is wrong on that, totally wrong. If you look at the numbers, if you look at the findings in Arizona, if you look at what's going on in Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, by the way, and take a look at Wisconsin, they're finding things that nobody thought possible. This was a corrupt election.
I just have to point out Doug Logan, to name one of the states that you just named, Doug Logan, who ran the audit in Arizona that was set up by your allies, didn't find serious problems. This is a quote: "The ballots that were provided to us to count in the Coliseum very accurately correlate with the official canvas numbers." He raised a bunch of administrative issues, but didn't find a problem that would have changed the result at all.
The ballots may correspond, but look at the ballots themselves. What you really have to do in that report is look at the findings. And the findings are devastating for Arizona. They're devastating like nobody's seen before.
And Steve, when you pressed him further, he said that the people who conducted the recount in Maricopa County, he referred to them as rhinos, Republicans in name only, even though they were commissioned by Trump loyalists. Later, you asked him if he'd demand that Republican candidates keep pushing these false claims of election fraud. How did that go over?
Yeah, there's so much to discuss here. First, Tanya, I want to emphasize what we just heard in that tape that we played. The president has expanded and adapted his arguments as more and more information has come in proving that he lost the 2020 election. He has to keep widening the conspiracy to include more people who are disloyal or who have turned against him. And in Arizona, there are absolutely Trump loyalists who ran that audit and didn't find clear evidence of anything, really, except a fair election. The discussion went on, and we're getting now toward the end of this hang-up call, and here's how we got to that point. Let's listen.
No sitting president has ever gotten the number of votes that I got.
A lot of sitting president.
Nobody believes. You think Biden got 80 million votes? How come when he went to speak in different locations. Nobody came to watch. But all of a sudden, he got 80 million votes.
Nobody believes that. Forgive me, maybe because the election was about you. If I can just move on to ask, are you telling Republicans in 2022 that they must press your case on the past election in order to get your endorsement? Is that an absolute?
They're going to do whatever they want to do. Whatever they have to do, they're going to do. But the ones that are smart, the ones that know, you take a look at, again, you take a look at how Carrie Lake is doing, running for governor. She's very big on this issue. She's leading by a lot. People have no idea how big this issue is, and they don't want it to happen again. It shouldn't be allowed to happen, and they don't want it to happen again. And the only way it's not going to happen again is you have to solve the problem of the presidential rigged election of 2020.
Mr. President, thank you very much. I appreciate it. One more question. I want to ask about a court hearing yesterday on January 6th. Judge Amit Mehta, he's gone. Okay.
And just like that, he's gone. Steve, you agreed to a 15-minute interview. As we know, you've been asking for an interview for many years. He hung up at 9 minutes, 21 seconds in. How are you reflecting on what you heard from the former president?
It did take a long time to get that 9 minutes and 21 seconds. I was glad to get what I could and would get more if I could get it, to be honest with you. But regardless of whether an interview subject talks to you or not, lies to you or not, is informative or not, I think it's our obligation as journalists to go to multiple sources, put things in context, and report what people around your subject are saying and doing. And that's what we did in the presentation of this interview on NPR. And that way, I think we can try to get a full picture as well as a full perspective on what the former president did and didn't tell us during that short phone call.
NPR Steve Inskeep talking about his interview with former President Donald Trump. You can hear the complete conversation at NPR.org. Steve, thank you so much.
Oh, I was glad to do it, Tanya. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now.